was one, then two, humans are genetically predisposed toward language and bipedal locomotion. Later, however, we face the task of learning skills for which there's no cooperative surrounding environment, skills for which we aren't as genetically predisposed to develop. Neither jet planes nor grand pianos were involved in the early evolution of Homo sapiens. More and more as we emerge into the teen and adult years, we must find our own doors to mastery. Chapters 5 through 9 present 5 keys to opening those doors. Chapter 5. Key 1. Instruction. There are some skills you can learn on your own, and some you can try to learn. But if you intend to take the journey of mastery, the best thing you can do is to arrange for first-rate instruction. The self-taught person is on a chancy path. There are advantages. You enjoy the license of not knowing what can't be done. You might wander into fertile territory previously ruled out by mainline explorers. Some of those who have taught themselves, Edison for one, Buckminster Fuller for another, have made it work. Most, however, have spent their lives reinventing the wheel, then refusing to concede that it's out of round. Even those who will someday overthrow conventional ways of thinking or doing need to know what it is they are overthrowing. Instruction comes in many forms. For mastering most skills, there's nothing better than being in the hands of a master teacher, either one-to-one or in a small group. But there are also books, films, tapes, computer learning programs, computerized simulators, flight simulators, for example, group instruction, the classroom, knowledgeable friends, counselors, business associates, even the street. Still, the individual teacher or coach can serve as a standard for all forms of instruction, the first and brightest beacon on the journey of mastery. The search for good instruction starts with a look at credentials and lineage. Who was your teacher's teacher? Who was that teacher's teacher, and so on, back to the timeless time when individual identity disappears in the myth of first beginnings. These are perhaps quaint questions in an age that has let the cord of lineage come almost completely unraveled, but good questions nonetheless. Even tapes and books and computer learning programs have an ancestry. Respect for credentials, however, shouldn't blind you to other considerations. The instructor who advertises as an 8th-degree black belt in one martial art, 9th-degree in another, and light middleweight champion of the world in both could be a lousy teacher. John McEnroe might turn up in later years as a superb tennis coach, but he might not. The teaching tactics of a Nobel laureate could turn out to be poison for the mind of a neophyte physicist. It's particularly challenging, in fact, for a top performer to become a first-rate teacher. Instruction demands a certain humility. At best, the teacher takes delight in being surpassed by his or her students. Gymnastics coach Bella Caroli would have a very hard time performing the moves he has taught to both Nadia Comăneci of Romania and Mary Lou Retton of the USA. To see the teacher clearly, look at the students. They are his work of art. If at all possible, attend an instructional session before choosing your teacher. Focus your attention on the students. Even more, on the interaction. Does the instructor proceed through praise or through damnation? There is the brand of teacher, often celebrated in myth if not in reality, who is famous for giving an absolute minimum of praise. When this teaching tactic works, it's through an economic principle, praise becoming so scarce a commodity that even a curt nod of grudging approval is taken to be highly rewarding. What doesn't work, despite a certain macho attitude to the contrary, is scorn, excoriation, humiliation, anything that destroys the student's confidence and self-esteem. Even the praise-stingy teacher must in some way show respect for the student in order to get long-term positive results. The best teacher generally strives to point out what the student is doing right at least as frequently as what she or he is doing wrong, which is just what UCLA coach John Wooden, perhaps the greatest basketball mentor of all time, managed to do all through his long, winning career. Wooden was observed to maintain approximately a 50-50 ratio between reinforcement and correction, with exceptional enthusiasm on both sides of the equation. Look again at the students, the interaction. Do the more talented, more advanced students get all the goodies? How about the klutzes, the beginners? Maybe you're looking for the type of instructor who's comfortable only with the best, only with potential champions. There are such teachers, and they serve a useful function, But for me, the essence of the instructor's art lies in the ability to work effectively and enthusiastically with beginners and to serve as a guide on the path of mastery for those who are neither as fast nor as talented as the norm. This service can be listed under altruism, but it's more than that. For to participate with a beginner in the first faltering mental and physical moves involved in learning a new skill is to penetrate the inner structure not only of that skill, but also of the process of mastery itself. Knowledge, expertise, technical skill, and credentials are important, but without the patience and empathy that go with teaching beginners, these merits are as nothing. The best of instructors, the worst of instructors. It was at the high water mark of a war that had surged all the way around the globe that I first found myself in the instructor's role. The top 6 graduates of Class 44C of the Advanced Flight School at Turner Field in Albany, Georgia, brand new second lieutenants with silver pilot's wings, were kept back and made flight instructors while the other 304 graduates were sent on to combat. Far from being pleased with our assignments, the 6 of us professed a burning desire for immediate combat duty, a sentiment that became maudlin after a few drinks at the officers' club on our nights off. I was 20 years old. The other 5 new instructors were about the same age. In March of 1944, despite our lack of experience, we were assigned students and, without a word of advice, sent up to teach them to fly the B-25, a high-performance medium bomber of the time. The invasion of Fortress Europe was imminent. The Pacific campaign, it was predicted, would last for years. Pilots, like the planes they would fly, had to be produced by the tens of thousands, never mind such niceties as stringent safety procedures. Flying conditions would have caused a major scandal in peacetime. Even on the darkest nights, with giant thunderstorms closing in, some 100 B-25s would jockey for position in the landing pattern at the end of each instructional period. There was nothing like a radar traffic control system. Our lives hung on visual acuity, flying skill, and fast reflexes. During the summer of 1944, 2 spectacular mid-air collisions at Turner Field resulted in the destruction of 4 planes and the tragic loss of the instructors and cadets flying them. The crashes never made the newspapers. There was no time for sympathy or second chances. Student pilots who didn't measure up were washed out, discarded like defective components coming off a production line. The 6 months I spent at Turner Field proved to be more challenging and actually more dangerous than the combat tour in the South Pacific that followed. After logging 600 hours as a flight instructor under the most demanding of conditions, I had gained a sure sense of the mastery of flight that has never left me. And what about my students? Ah, that's another story. Time provides no replays, but I am left, after all of these years, with crystalline memories of preternaturally white clouds soaring over deep green fields of cotton and corn, of the insistent engine sound that finally became no sound at all, of smoking engines and failed hydraulic systems, of illegal flights out over the Atlantic to play vertiginous games of follow the leader with other planes while our students held their breaths. But more than anything, I am left with a morality tale on the subject of instructing, in which I play the leading role. There's nothing I can do to change it. I was the best of instructors. I was the worst of instructors. The first does not justify the second. Each of us was given 4 students to guide through the entire 2 months of advanced training. I quickly discovered that 2 of my students, cadets by the name of Stull and Thatcher, were quite talented. The other 2, call them Brewster and Edmondson, were at best mediocre. This discrepancy suggested a plan. I would keep Stull and Thatcher together. I'd never let them fly with anyone else. They would be safe from contamination by lesser talents. This would allow me to initiate the 2 of them into a mode of flying a fellow instructor and I had developed while still cadets. We call it maximum performance, and it simply meant that we would fly as close as possible to perfection at all times, even when regulations didn't call for it, even when no one was watching. And so, without mentioning the words maximum performance, I set standards for Stull and Thatcher approximately 10 times more stringent than what was called for. Normally, while flying on instruments, pilots were given a leeway of 200 feet above or below the prescribed altitude. But I led Stull and Thatcher to believe they had only a 20-foot margin of error. I insisted they hold their gyro compass heading right on the money at all times. I taught them, even when landing on a 10,000-foot runway, to touch down on the first 100 feet. I gave Stull and Thatcher my very best, and they responded just as I had hoped they would. Even though I never let them fly with other cadets, they must have compared notes and figured out what I was up to. Sometimes when I described a particularly unreasonable standard of performance with a straight face, they were unable to keep from smiling. After the first few weeks, I too couldn't keep a smile off my face. We were joined in a delicious conspiracy of excellence. On the days I was scheduled to fly with them, I awakened with a feeling of excitement and anticipation. I can still see Stull and Thatcher with incredible clarity, one of them in the pilot's seat, the other standing in back and leaning down between the pilot's and co-pilot seats to watch yet another perfect approach and landing. The pure, prophetic light of another time still pours in through the plexiglass canopy, the towering clouds, the impossible blue of the sky, and the two cadets' faces still glow with the incomparable happiness that comes when you first embark on the journey of mastery. Now for the hard part of the story. After my first few flights with the cadets I'm calling Brewster and Edmondson, I simply lost interest. I was too young, too impatient, too arrogant in my espousal of maximum performance to endure their rather inept efforts at flying the B-25. Brewster was slim, patrician, and shy. Edmondson was heavy-set and confident, the squadron jokester. On one flight I thought he made a snide remark at my expense. I took the controls, climbed to 10,000 feet, and racked the plane around in maneuvers it was never meant to perform, leaving Edmondson and Brewster pale and shaken. I went through the motions. Now and then I made an effort to bring them along, to discover what was blocking their progress, to develop their potential to its fullest extent. But my enthusiasms were short-lived. Some particularly blatant display of crudity on the controls by Edmondson, or tentativeness on the part of Brewster, would cause me to shake my head in despair and disgust and either turn away and slump in my seat or take the controls and show them exactly how the maneuver should be done. As it turned out, Brewster and Edmondson graduated along with Stull and Thatcher, but just barely. After the war, I happened to run into Brewster at a dance in Atlanta. He took the opportunity, the force of his resentment overcoming any shyness he might have felt, to let me know exactly what he thought about his experiences with me at Turner Field. I had no adequate reply. Long before that time, I had begun to feel guilty about the way I had handled my first assignment as an instructor. In fact, I never again segregated my students as I had done the first time. I graduated 2 more groups of pilots before leaving for combat, experiencing neither the exhilaration I had felt with Stull and Thatcher, nor the despair I had felt with Brewster and Edmondson. I worked to control my impatience, to do the best I could with the slower students. Still, a continuing preoccupation with maximum performance along with an extremity of youth tended to frustrate my own performance as a teacher of the less talented. The magic of teaching beginners. Many years later, I found myself once again in the instructor's role, engaged this time in an art far more subtle and complex and difficult to learn than flying. I was 47 when a friend invited me to join the Aikido class he was organizing. I'd never heard of Aikido, nor had I ever dreamed of becoming a martial artist. That was 20 years ago, and I can now say that practicing Aikido has been the second most profound learning experience of my life. Teaching Aikido has been the most profound. Even before getting my first degree black belt, I was enlisted by my teacher as an assistant instructor. My job, teaching the basics of the art to beginners. 6 years later, in October 1976, shortly after getting our black belts, 2 of my fellow Aikidoists and I started our own dojo. From rather questionable beginnings 14 years ago, it's not customary for first-degree black belts to start their own school, Aikido of Tamalpais has become a respected and happy dojo. We 3 founders have continued developing our skills and have advanced to higher ranks. From the thousands of students who have practiced at our school for varying lengths of time have come 28 black belts, not an insignificant number, in a difficult art that offers no cheap degrees. At this point, I'd like to be able to tell you that by now I've mastered the art of teaching slow students and beginners, but that wouldn't be true. I still have to work at it. I listen carefully when Wendy Palmer, one of my partners, tells me that teaching beginners and slow students is not only fascinating but pleasurable. The talented student, she believes, is likely to learn so fast that small stages in the learning process are glossed over, creating an opaque surface that hides the secrets of the art from view. With the slow student, though, the teacher is forced to deal with small, incremental steps that penetrate like X-rays the very essence of the art and clearly reveal the process through which the art becomes manifest in movement. Gradually, the mystery is unfolded. My experience as an instructor has shown me, for one thing, that the most talented students don't necessarily make the best martial artists. Sometimes, strangely enough, those with exceptional talent have trouble staying on the path of mastery. In 1987, my colleagues at Esquire and I conducted a series of interviews with athletes known as masters of their sports, which tended to confirm this paradoxical finding. Most of the athletes we interviewed stressed hard work and experience over raw talent. "I have seen so many baseball players with God-given ability who just didn't want to work," Rod Carew said. "They were soon gone. I've seen others with no ability to speak of who stayed in the big leagues for 14 or 15 years. Good horse, bad horse. In his book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Zen master Shunryu Suzuki approaches the question of fast and slow learners in terms of horses. In our scriptures, it is said that there are four kinds of horses: excellent ones, good ones, poor ones, and bad ones. The best horse will run slow and fast, right and left, at the driver's will, before it sees the shadow of the whip. The second best will run as well as the first one, just before the whip reaches its skin. The third one will run when it feels pain on its body. The fourth will run after the pain penetrates to the marrow of its bones. You can imagine how difficult it is for the fourth one to learn to run. When we hear this story, almost all of us want to be the best horse. If it is impossible to be the best one, we want to be the second best. But this is a mistake, Master Suzuki says. When you learn too easily, you're tempted not to work hard, not to penetrate to the marrow of a practice. If you study calligraphy, you will find that those who are not so clever usually become the best calligraphers. Those who are very clever with their hands often encounter great difficulty after they have reached a certain stage. This is also true in art and in life. The best horse, according to Suzuki, may be the worst horse, and the worst horse can be the best, for if it perseveres, it will have learned whatever it is practicing all the way to the marrow of its bones. Suzuki's parable of the four horses has haunted me ever since I first heard it. For one thing, it poses a clear challenge for the person with exceptional talent. To achieve his or her full potential, this person will have to work just as diligently as those with less innate ability. The parable has made me realize that if I'm the first or second horse as an instructor of fast learners, I'm the third or fourth horse as an instructor of slow learners. But there is hope. If I persevere and dedicate my efforts to bringing along every Brewster and Edmondson who shows up at our Aikido school, I'll someday know this aspect of instructing all the way to the marrow of my bones. So when you look for your instructor in whatever skill or art, spend a moment celebrating it when you discover one who pursues maximum performance, but also make sure that he or she is paying exquisite attention to the slowest student on the mat. Comparing various modes of instruction. How about the other modes of instruction? In most cases, audio and video tapes have only limited effectiveness. Learning eventually involves interaction between the learner and the learning environment, and its effectiveness relates to the frequency, quality, variety, and intensity of the interaction. With tapes, there's no real interaction at all. Information flows in one direction only. A videotape can show you an ideal golf swing to copy, and that's certainly better than nothing. But the tape has no way of observing your swing and telling you how well you're replicating the ideal. With remote control, the tape can be easily stopped, reversed, repeated, and in some cases played in slow motion, all of which makes it much better than instructional films or television programs, which march along at a steady rate regardless of the learner's progress or understanding. A book is also self-paced, and it's portable and handy. Like tape, it suffers from lack of feedback capability. Still, in spite of the marvels of the computer age, the book remains a major tool for learning, especially in skills that are primarily cognitive. If a picture is sometimes worth 1,000 words, then perhaps a moving picture is worth 10,000 words. But it's also true that one good paragraph sometimes has more power to change the individual and the world than any number of pictures. The typical school or college classroom, unhappily, is not a very good place to learn. Frontal teaching, with one instructor sitting or standing in front of 20 to 35 students who are sitting at fixed desks, is primarily an administrative expediency, a way of parceling out and keeping track of the flood of students in mass education. It's sad that over the past 100 years, almost every aspect of our national life, industry, transportation, communication, computation, entertainment, has changed almost beyond recognition, while our schools remain essentially the same. Take a look. There it is, one teacher giving out the same information at the same rate to a group of mostly passive students, regardless of their individual abilities, cultural backgrounds, or learning styles. I've written at some length on this subject and on the type of reform that could remedy the situation through the self-pacing and individualizing capabilities of the computer and other new instructional modes. I believe that within 10 or 15 years at the most, some sort of school reform along these lines is inevitable. Meanwhile, there are still good teachers and bad teachers. Visits to hundreds of schools have convinced me that the teacher who can make the present system work is undoubtedly a master. He or she is not necessarily the one who gives the most polished lectures, but rather the one who has discovered how to involve each student actively in the process of learning. One award-winning mathematician at a major university was famous for intentionally making small mistakes when he wrote formulas on the chalkboard. Students sat on the edge of their chairs, vying to be the first to catch the mistake and rush up to correct their professor. Truly a master of the instructor's art. Knowing when to say goodbye. Fortunate is the person who can find such a teacher, especially at the beginning of the learning process. Students at school, up to and including college, often don't have much choice. Even those of us who do have a choice sometimes make a bad one. If you should end up with a teacher who doesn't seem right for you, first look inside. You might well be expecting more than any teacher can give. But teachers as well as students can be lazy, excessively goal-oriented, indifferent, psychologically seductive, or just plain inept. It's important to keep the proper psychological distance. If you're too far removed, there's no chance for the surrender that's part of the master's journey. Listen to Chapter 7. If you come too close, you lose all perspective and become a disciple rather than a student. The responsibility for good balance lies with student as well as teacher. When irreconcilable differences do occur, remember that the better part of wisdom is knowing when to say goodbye. Bear in mind that on the path of mastery, learning never ends. In the words of the great Japanese sword master Yamaoka Teshu, "Do not think that this is all there is. More and more wonderful teachings exist. The sword is unfathomable." Chapter 6. Key 2. Practice. It's an old joke that appears in many versions, but always sends the same message. In one version, a couple of Texans in a Cadillac on their way to a concert are lost in New York's Lower East Side. They stop to question a bearded elder. "How do you get to Carnegie Hall?" they ask. "Practice," he tells them. That usage of the word, practice as a verb, is clear to all of us. You practice your trumpet, your dance routine, your multiplication tables, your combat mission. To practice in this sense implies something separate from the rest of your life. You practice in order to learn a skill, in order to improve yourself, in order to get ahead, achieve goals, make money. This way of thinking about practice is useful in our society. You obviously have to practice to get to Carnegie Hall. For one who is on the master's journey, however, the word is best conceived of as a noun, not as something you do, but as something you have, something you are. In this sense, the word is akin to the Chinese word Dao and the Japanese word Do, both of which mean literally road or path. Practice is the path upon which you travel, just that. A practice, as a noun, can be anything you practice on a regular basis as an integral part of your life, not in order to gain something else, but for its own sake. It might be a sport or a martial art. It might be gardening or bridge or yoga or meditation or community service. A doctor practices medicine and an attorney practices law, and each of them also has a practice. But if that practice is only a collection of patients or clients, a way of making a living, it isn't a master's practice. For a master, the rewards gained along the way are fine, but they are not the main reason for the journey. Ultimately, the master and the master's path are one, and if the traveler is fortunate, that is, if the path is complex and profound enough, the destination is 2 miles farther away for every mile he or she travels. A woman in one of our workshops asked my wife Annie why she was still going to Aikido classes. "I thought you'd already gotten your black belt," she said. It took Annie a few minutes to explain that a black belt is only one more step along an endless path, a license to go on learning for as long as you live. In a nation obsessed with the achievement of goals, it doesn't matter how you score, the score is all that counts. Don't tell me how you are going to sell the ad, just sell it. Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. Devotion to the goalless journey might seem incomprehensible, if not bizarre. But behind the slogans you read on the sports page and in the business section, there's a deeper reality. The master goes along with the rhetoric about scoring and winning. In today's media climate, who would listen to anything else? But secretly cherishes those games filled with delicious twists and turns of fortune, great plays, close calls, and magical finishes, regardless of who wins. There's another secret. The people we know as masters don't devote themselves to their particular skill just to get better at it. The truth is they love to practice, and because of this, they do get better, and then, to complete the circle, the better they get, the more they enjoy performing the basic moves, over and over again. Beginners at the basics classes at our Aikido school will do a simple blending move about 8 or 10 times, then start looking around restlessly for something new to distract them. Black belts at the basics classes have the knowledge and experience, the feel, necessary to appreciate the subtleties and endless possibilities contained with even the most rudimentary technique. I remember an Aikido class years ago when I was a brown belt, the rank just below black belt. Our teacher started us doing a technique called Shihonage, four-way throw, then continued with the same variation of the same technique for the entire two-hour class. After the first half hour, I began wondering what was coming next. Our school rarely practiced the same technique for so long a time. By the end of the first hour, however, I had settled into a steady, trance-like rhythm that obliterated all considerations of time or repetition. My perceptions expanded. The barely noticeable variations from one throw to the next became significant and revealing. By the end of the second hour, I was hoping that the class would go on until midnight, that it would never end. Staying on the mat. The master, an old martial arts saying goes, is the one who stays on the mat 5 minutes longer every day than anybody else, and not just in Aikido. In August 1988, I visited the Seattle Seahawks training camp as a guest of the team's offensive coordinator. When the morning practice session was over, the players shambled off the field to the dressing room, all of the players, except two, that is. One of the two kept running out, then wheeling suddenly to take a pass from the other. Again and again he ran the same pattern, caught the same pass. The field was empty. The other players were inside taking their showers, getting dressed. The coaches, too, were gone, and the spectators had drifted away. I remained there on the sidelines, fascinated. Who was this eager pass receiver? Surely it was some brand new rookie, someone trying to get good enough to make the team. No. It was Steve Largent, not only the premier pass receiver of the Seattle Seahawks, but the leading receiver in the history of the National Football League. The master of any game is generally a master of practice. In his prime, Larry Bird of the Boston Celtics was perhaps the most complete basketball player of all time. Unable to jump as high or run as fast as many other players, he was named National Basketball Association Rookie of the Year for 1980, Most Valuable Player in two championship series, and the league MVP for 3 years in a row. Bird began developing his basketball practice at age 4 and never stopped practicing. After the Celtics won the NBA championship in June 1986, reporters asked Bird what he planned to do next. "I've still got some things I want to work on," he was quoted as saying. "I'll start my off-season training next week, 2 hours a day with at least 100 free throws." Many professionals take some of the summer off, but not Larry Bird. He runs for conditioning up and down the steepest hills he can find. On the blacktop court with glass backboard at home in French Lick, Indiana, he practices. During the season, in the Hellenic College gym in Brookline, he practices. On road trips, in arenas all around the country, before every game, he practices. During his years with the Celtics, Bird was known for getting on the court an hour or two before everyone else to practice his shots, foul shots, fallaway shots, three-pointers, shots from all sorts of angles. Sometimes, just for fun, he would sit on the sideline and pop them in, or find a seat in the first row and float them in. No question, Bird likes to win. Still, according to his agent Bob Wolf, that's not the main reason he practices so diligently and plays so wholeheartedly. He does it just to enjoy himself, not to make money, to get acclaim, to gain stature. He just loves to play basketball. Explicit skills such as those found in martial arts, sports, dance, music, and the like, provide explicit examples of practice. But this second key to mastery undergirds a wide variety of human endeavors. Good business practice demands that managers keep the mechanics of their operations current at all times, being especially diligent and disciplined in such basic matters as budget, order fulfillment, and quality control. The families that stay together hold fast to certain rituals regardless of the haste and distractions of daily life. This might mean having one full, sit-down meal every day with every family member present. Nations also have their practice, as seen, for example, in the regular and heartfelt observance of national festivals and sacred days. This nation indulges in a questionable experiment in casually changing the dates of its holidays, holy days, for the sake of commerce and four-day weekends. To practice regularly, even when you seem to be getting nowhere, might at first seem onerous. But the day eventually comes when practicing becomes a treasured part of your life. You settle into it, as if into your favorite easy chair, unaware of time and the turbulence of the world. It will still be there for you tomorrow. It will never go away. "How long will it take me to master Aikido?" a prospective student asks. "How long do you expect to live?" is the only respectable response. Ultimately, practice is the path of mastery. If you stay on it long enough, you'll find it to be a vivid place, with its ups and downs, its challenges and comforts, its surprises, disappointments, and unconditional joys. You'll take your share of bumps and bruises while traveling, bruises of the ego as well as of the body, mind, and spirit, but it might well turn out to be the most reliable thing in your life. Then, too, it might eventually make you a winner in your chosen field, if that's what you're looking for, and then people will refer to you as a master. But that's not really the point. What is mastery? At the heart of it, mastery is practice. Mastery is staying on the path. Chapter 7. Key 3. Surrender. The courage of a master is measured by his or her willingness to surrender. This means surrendering to your teacher and to the demands of your discipline. It also means surrendering your own hard-won proficiency from time to time in order to reach a higher or different level of proficiency. The early stages of any significant new learning invoke the spirit of the fool. Listen to the epilogue. It's almost inevitable that you'll feel clumsy, that you'll take literal or figurative pratfalls. There's no way around it. The beginner who stands on his or her dignity becomes rigid, armored. The learning can't get through. This doesn't mean that you should surrender your own physical and moral center or passively accept teachings that would be bad for you, but you've already checked out your instructor. See key 1. Now's the time for a certain suspension of disbelief. So your teacher asks you to begin by putting your finger on your nose and standing on one foot. Unless there's some compelling reason to the contrary, just surrender. Give it a try. After all, learning almost any significant skill involves certain indignities. Your first few dives are likely to be belly flops, and they'll draw the attention of almost everyone at the pool. Are you willing to accept that? If not, forget diving. The face you draw in your first art class looks more like Mr. Potato Head than the Mona Lisa. Is that a good reason for giving up art? And how about those fluttering ankles the first few times you try ice skating, and the impact of the hard, cold ice on the part of the body normally reserved for spankings? Punishment of this sort isn't limited to beginners. It happens in the Olympics. If you want to get there, be prepared to take it. And then there are the endless repetitions, the drudgery, the basic moves practiced over and over again. Who but a fool would embark on a musical career in the full knowledge that he or she might end up repeating all the major and minor scales perhaps 100,000 times each? To some people, that prospect alone might seem to justify resisting any surrender. About halfway through my third Aikido class, my teacher demonstrated Tai no Henko, the most basic blending movement in the art. Without a moment's thought, I heard myself saying, "We've already done that technique." That remark didn't even elicit a reply, just a faintly amused smile. My surrender was definitive. Since then, I practiced Tai no Henko at least 50,000 times. Actually, the essence of boredom is to be found in the obsessive search for novelty. Satisfaction lies in mindful repetition, the discovery of endless richness in subtle variations on familiar themes. Swordmaster Stories. The literature of the East is loaded with swordmaster and apprentice stories. All have the same general drift. A young man learns of a master of the sword who lives in a far province. After a long and difficult journey, he presents himself at the master's door and asks to become his student. The master closes the door in the young man's face. Every day thereafter, the young man comes to sit on the master's doorstep, simply waiting. A year passes, and the master grudgingly allows the young man to do chores around the house, chop wood, carry water. Months more go by, maybe years. One morning, without warning, the master attacks the young man from behind and whacks him on the shoulder with a bamboo sword, a shinai. The master has begun to teach alertness. At length, the master gives his apprentice his own shinai and continues teaching him the art of the sword, to which the student has been surrendering all along. In a nation that has made a book entitled Total Fitness in 12 Minutes a Week into a national bestseller, such stories might tend to have little meaning. Still, the swordmaster myth has the power to penetrate our popular culture, if only in an Americanized version. The first and best Karate Kid movie condenses the years of the myth into a few months, having the apprentice painting the karate master's fence and waxing his car rather than chopping wood and carrying water. Surrendering to your teacher and to the fundamentals of the art are only the beginning. There are times in almost every master's journey when it becomes necessary to give up some hard-won competence in order to advance to the next stage. This is especially true when you're stuck at a familiar and comfortable skill level. The parable of the cup and the quart applies here. There's a quart of milk on the table within your reach, but you're holding a cup of milk in your hand, and you're afraid to let go of the cup in order to get the quart. Your fear isn't without foundation. If you've been shooting in the 90s for quite a while on the golf links and want to get your score down into the 80s or even the 70s, you might well have to give up the 90s for a while. You might have to take your game apart before putting it back together. This is true of almost any skill. For many years I had played jazz piano for my own amusement. I had developed a small repertory in a limited set of keys using rather unadventurous chording. Every time I wrote or spoke about the character I call the hacker, or looked at the curve describing the hacker's progress, I thought about my own piano playing and said to myself, "That's me." About a year ago, egged on by my Aikido partner, Wendy, a talented singer and guitarist, I found myself playing with a small jazz group, learning new songs in new keys, changing all of my chord voicing, and in general, shooting for a level of play I had never dreamed of. At first, everything started falling apart. Where was my comfortable old solo style? I had let go the cup and hadn't yet grasped the quart. I was floundering in the scary, slippery space between competencies. Just then, we were given the opportunity of playing at a local jazz spot. Someone, could it have been me, said seize the day, and I found myself going straight from the land of the hacker to the land of the obsessive, without even a side trip through the larger country of mastery, practicing so strenuously that I developed an inflamed tendon in my right little finger and had to ice my hand each time I played. Somehow the performance passed without disaster, and now I'm groping my way toward the slow lane on the path of mastery in this skill. A Tale of Two Experts. How do you respond when offered the chance of renouncing a present competency for a higher or different one? The story of two karate experts, call them Russell and Tony, trying to learn Aikido might serve as a guide. Both of them were participants in an 8-week certification program that required Aikido training 5 days a week. It was my job to teach the class. Russell was small, wiry, intense, and scholarly, an exceptionally gracious person who went out of his way to be helpful to his fellow students. He held a doctorate and was director of professional training in a large organization. In addition, he had a first-degree black belt in karate. Tony's schooling had been accomplished mostly on the streets of Jersey City. He had come to the martial arts early in life, and now at 31, he held a fourth-degree karate black belt and was owner of 2 karate schools. From the moment Russell stepped on the training mat, he revealed that he was a trained martial artist. His individual warm-up routine included several karate moves. When called upon to deliver a punch during class, he resorted to the specialized style of his previous discipline. Once, on a 2-hand grab attack, I noticed him moving purposefully to keep a maximum distance between his body and that of the person he was attacking. I suggested he stay closer and let himself flow with the attack. "Surely you jest," he said with a laugh. I told him that in order to learn the basic moves, it would be better just for now to forget defensive possibilities. We would learn to cover any openings later. I could see that Russell was finding it hard to let go of his expertise, and because of this failing, to get the most out of his Aikido training. After the first 4 weeks, he was falling behind some of those who had never done any martial art, and it was only at this point that he finally surrendered his prior competence and got on the path of mastery. Tony's approach was different. From the beginning, he never made a move, not even a gesture, that might reveal he was an expert in another art. Without a hint of ostentation, he showed more respect than did any of the other students for his teachers, this in spite of his high rank. He carried himself with an air of calm sincerity and was unfailingly aware of everything going on around him. Along with this was a powerful presence that could be quickly recognized by any trained martial artist. Just by the way he sat, stood, and walked, Tony revealed himself as a fellow traveler on the path of mastery. During a class at the end of the first 4 weeks, I had all the students sit at the edge of the mat, then asked Tony if he would show us one of his karate kata, predetermined sequence of movements. He bowed, walked to the center of the mat, and breathed deeply for a few moments. What followed brought a sharp intake of breath from almost all of us. Moving gracefully and faster than the eye could fully comprehend, Tony launched one swift and deadly strike and kick after another, leaping, spinning, emitting resounding kai-ai shouts as he dispatched imaginary foes at every point of the compass. When it was over, he once again bowed humbly and returned to the edge of the mat to take his place with the others, the most thoroughgoing beginner of them all. Perhaps the best you can hope for on the master's journey, whether your art be management or marriage, badminton or ballet, is to cultivate the mind and heart of the beginning at every stage along the way. For the master, surrender means there are no experts. There are only learners. Chapter 8. Key 4. Intentionality. It joins old words with new. Character, willpower, attitude, imaging, the mental game. But what I'm calling intentionality, however you look at it, is an essential to take along on the master's journey. The power of the mental game came to public awareness in the 1970s through the revelations of some of the nation's most notable sports figures. Golfer Jack Nicklaus, for example, let it be known that he never hit a shot without first clearly visualizing the ball's perfect flight and its triumphant destination, sitting up there high and white and pretty on the green. A successful shot, Nicklaus told us, was 50% visualization, 40% setup, and only 10% swing. Premier pro running backs described imaging each of their plays again and again the night before a game. They felt that their success on the field the next day was closely related to the vividness of their mental practice. Bodybuilders and weightlifters testified to the value of intentionality. Arnold Schwarzenegger argued that pumping a weight one time with full consciousness was worth 10 without mental awareness. He was joined by Frank Zane and others in vouching for the effect of the mind on such physical qualities as muscle and iron. What has happened was that sports training and technique had reached an extremely high level of development, so high that further improvements along this line could come only in tiny increments. When Jack Nicklaus attributed only 10% of the success of a shot to the swing, it was perhaps because his swing was already nearly perfect. The realm of mind and spirit was the undiscovered land, the place where pioneers in sports performance could make the greatest gains. To exploit this opportunity, a number of top-ranking teams and individuals have hired sports psychologists to teach relaxation, confidence, and the mental rehearsal of specific plays or moves. This has led to audio tapes and videotapes purported to hone the mental game for sports aspirants who can't afford their own psychologists. The messages on some of these tapes are less than sophisticated. Mind Communications Incorporated, for example, puts out subliminal affirmations on audio tape. Beneath the sound of waves or pink sound, certain words or phrases are spoken just below the level of ordinary awareness. The tape for football contains these phrases: I know my plays, I am important, I can do it, I love to run, I relax, I use weights for strength, I get off the ball first, I avoid sugar, coffee, alcohol, tobacco, I love contact, I set a goal, I love exercise, I have good hands, I can beat my man, drive, 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 I breathe deeply and evenly, I am a winner. No research has yet been conducted to see if these messages make better football players. Dr. Richard M. Suen at Colorado State University has come up with a more sophisticated method called Visuomotor Behavior Rehearsal, VMBR, which combines exercises in deep relaxation with vivid mental imaging of the skill to be learned. In one study of VMBR, researchers at North Texas State University divided 32 students in a beginning karate class into four groups. They assigned each group a different practice to do at home during a six-week period in which they would meet twice a week for karate lessons. At the start, they gave each student baseline anxiety and skills tests, then launched them on their various types of practice. 1. Deep muscle relaxation only. 2. Imaging only, closing their eyes and doing karate moves in their mind's eye. 3. VMBR, relaxation exercises, followed by imaging. And 4. No home practice. All the groups received traditional karate instruction. At the end of the 6 weeks, the researchers again tested the students for anxiety, and the karate school gave its customary skill tests in basic moves and sparring. The VMBR and relaxation-only groups recorded lower levels of anxiety than the others. In sparring, the VMBR group clearly outscored the other three. This test and others along the same line show results that are statistically significant, but not spectacular. For one thing, the time period of most of these studies is relatively short. For another, the people used in the experiments are mostly beginners. These limitations make such studies less compelling than the numerous anecdotal reports of master athletes. For me, the most compelling evidence of the power of imaging comes from direct experience on the Aikido mat. Our particular lineage of the art employs many metaphors and images to go along with the mechanics of movement. and it is from the unsubstantial realm of mind or spirit that the most powerful physical results flow. For example, one version of Nikayo, a wrist lock, involves being grabbed at the wrist by an attacker, then holding the attacker's hand on your wrist while bringing your hand around and over his wrist and pressing downward at a certain angle. When performed properly, this subtle maneuver can bring a much larger and stronger attacker to his or her knees. A purely mechanical application of Nikayo might work, but only through the application of considerable muscular force. There are certain imaging strategies, however, that increase its effectiveness to a degree that isn't just statistically significant, but truly startling. I ask my students to bring their hand, fingers extended, over the attacker's wrist as usual, then not to think of the wrist at all, but rather create long extensions of these fingers to go right through the attacker's face like laser beams and touch the base of the skull. From this point, they simply stroke gently downward on the attacker's spine with their imaged finger extensions. All other things being equal, the effectiveness of the technique depends on the vividness of the image. In my own Aikido practice, the imaged technique seems considerably more effective than muscular force alone. Sometimes an attacker goes down like a shot with a startled look on his face, while I am unaware of using any muscular force at all. What is really real? How do we explain the discrepancy between the mechanical and the imaged application? Are the magically extended fingers mere figments of the imagination, or are they in some way real? The easiest explanation derives from mechanics alone. Perhaps the image of extended fingers stroking down the attacker's spine simply provides guidance for bringing the Aikidoist into the proper alignment for the application of Nikayo. It certainly does that, but many years of experience have convinced me that more than alignment is involved. My logical mind tells me I don't really have fingers 3 feet long that can penetrate through another person's body to his or her spine. Still, the truly effortless, seemingly miraculous applications of the technique occur only when the mental image is vividly clear and when I can somehow feel my fingers moving down the attacker's spine. Which brings us to the question of what is really real. Is consciousness a mere epiphenomenon, as behaviorist B.F. Skinner would have it, or is the poet William Blake right in suggesting that mental things alone are real? Or, if mental constructs and the stuff of the objective world are both real, though occupying different classes of reality, then what is the nature of the interaction between the two classes? These are large questions for a short book, even for a long one. Still, it's possible to say rather briefly and obviously that thought, images, feelings, and the like are quite real, and that they do have a great influence on the world of matter and energy. Indeed, it's possible to argue that pure information is more persistent than what we class as substantial, or perhaps that both are at essence the same thing. More and more, the universe looks like a great thought rather than a great machine, says astronomer Sir James Jeans. Solomon's Temple, for example, no longer exists in the form of wood, stone, and gold. You can't find it anywhere. Yet it bursts into graphic, detailed existence in your mind's eye when you read 1 Kings 6 and 7 of the Bible. Neither Scarlett O'Hara nor Anna Karenina were ever made flesh, yet it might be the case that you know them better than your next-door neighbor. Your portable transistor radio is certainly real. You can feel it in your hands. But so is the wiring diagram for that radio, and so is that diagram as it evolved in the mind of the inventor. Which is more real? It's hard to say. While the underlying structure, the abstract relationship among the parts, is the same in all three forms, it can be argued that what is most abstract is most fundamental and often most persistent over time. The diagram or the mental picture will probably outlast the radio you hold in your hands, and these insubstantial forms have an additional advantage. If you want to make changes in the relationships of the parts, it's easier to do so in the diagram or the mind than in the three-dimensional radio. What's the role of intentionality here? It's certainly involved in the creation of the structure as idea. It's also involved in the transformation of that structure from one of its forms to another. This sort of transformation, in fact, is what the process of mastery is all about. Sometimes I have my students hold the vision or the feeling of a certain throw in their mind, and then practice it over and over for an hour or more until they are drenched with sweat and wiped clean of their previous thoughts or feelings about the throw. This use of intentionality often produces favorable results in the palpable, three-dimensional world of the martial arts. Thoughts, images, and feelings are indeed quite real. Einstein's thought that energy is equal to mass times the speed of light squared, E equals mc squared, eventually unleashed awesome power. The transformation of that thought into heat and percussion was a long and arduous process. Still, the thought, the vision, the intentionality was primary. "All I know," said Arnold Schwarzenegger, "is that the first step is to create the vision, because when you see the vision there, the beautiful vision, that creates the want power. For example, my wanting to be Mr. Universe came about because I saw myself so clearly being up there on the stage and winning." Intentionality fuels the master's journey. Every master is a master of vision. Chapter 9. Key 5. The Edge. Now we come, as come we must in anything of real consequence, to a seeming contradiction, a paradox. Almost without exception, those we know as masters are dedicated to the fundamentals of their calling. They are zealots of practice, connoisseurs of the small, incremental step. At the same time, and here's the paradox, these people, these masters, are precisely the ones who are likely to challenge previous limits, to take risks for the sake of higher performance, and even to become obsessive at times in that pursuit. Clearly for them, the key is not either or, it's both and. Chuck Yeager, the hero of Tom Wolfe's book The Right Stuff, is considered by many to be the best pilot who ever lived. Near the end of his autobiography, Yeager, he sums up what it means to be a great pilot, to have the right stuff. In the first two pages of this summary, he cites experience three times. If there is such a thing as the right stuff in piloting, Yeager tells us, then it is experience. And yet, this proponent of the plateau, this traveler on the endless path, is also a man who speaks with wicked delight about exploring the edges of the envelope. The night before he was scheduled to make a faster-than-sound flight for the first time in history, Yeager fell off a horse during a wild twilight ride and seriously sprained his shoulder. This injury would make it impossible for him to close the hatch on the X-1 rocket plane in the normal manner after he was loaded into it from the mothership at 20,000 feet. Undaunted, he took along a broom handle so that he could close the door with his other hand, then went on to push through the sound barrier despite his injury. The trick here is not only to test the edges of the envelope, but also to walk the fine line between endless, goalless practice and those alluring goals that appear along the way. At our dojo, we present Aikido, first of all, as an endless path, but we also have periodic examinations that are rigorous, challenging, and sometimes quite dramatic. The exam for first-degree black belt is, in particular, a rite of passage. The candidate faces a 3 to 6 months-long period leading up to the exam, which becomes not only an intensive cram course in advanced techniques, but also a physical and psychological trial by fire. During this ordeal, no personal flaw, no secret idiosyncrasy is likely to remain hidden. If all goes well, the exam itself becomes an expression not of ego, but of essence, a climactic and transcendent moment in a long journey. But the journey is what counts. In the words of the ancient Eastern adage, before enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. The new black belt is expected to be on the mat the next day, ready to take the first fall. Playing the edge is a balancing act. It demands the awareness to know when you're pushing yourself beyond safe limits. In this awareness, the man or woman on the path of mastery sometimes makes a conscious decision to do just that. We see this clearly in running, a sport so pure, so explicit, that everything